You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome into the latest edition of ESPN FC. I'm Dan Thomas. It is transfer deadline day, but we have to be honest, there's a massive snowstorm at the moment going on in Connecticut, where our studios are, so we're recording this before the deadline. So who knows what we could be missing? We're guessing not very much. Don Hutchinson, Stevie Nicol and Julien Laurent with us. Jules, if the most exciting thing that happens on deadline day is that Liverpool get Ben Davis and Ozan Kabak, that seems to be it.
Yeah, I mean, it's still very exciting if you're a Liverpool fan, although you can wonder why. No, but it's true, but you can still wonder why waiting so long this month to go for Ben Davis and Ozan Kabak, I guess, you know. So apart from that, if you're anybody else, and even, you're right, even if you're some Liverpool fans, that won't get you excited too much, although Kabak especially is a very highly rated young centre-back in Germany, at Schalke, the Turk international. I think there's something there, certainly, and that's what I think Liverpool saw that. It's a good deal to make. It's a loan with a £1 million fee, as a loan fee, which is okay. Then they've got an option to buy if they want to, of £18 million in the summer. They don't have to take that. That's not mandatory. So I think this is a good deal for Liverpool. See how he is adapting. See what you want to do in the summer. But for Ben Davis, he was very good in the Championship. Will he be able to make the step up to the Premier League with Liverpool? We'll have to see.
Stevie, how difficult is it for these players coming in to be thrown into this sort of situation?
Well, it'll depend on what's going on between their ears. I would suspect that it may be a little bit more overwhelming for Ben Davis than it would be from Kabak. So I would suggest that he would be the first one in line in front of Davis, just because of the experience factor. You know, playing in the Bundesliga, albeit in a team that are struggling, but he certainly looked, from what I've seen, a lot more composed with his challenges and certainly on the ball than Davis would be. So, yeah, it depends how the mentality of the two guys are. If they're calm, if they're quite assured of their own ability, regardless of whether it's up to Liverpool standard, then they will do a job.
How consequential are these transfers regarding the defence of the title, Don? If they come in and do well, obviously then you've got your boys can move back into your greatest midfield ever, and then Liverpool once again can push City all the way.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's going to have a bearing on the title. I think, as Stevie said, the youngster's going to take a lot of time to settle in and try and integrate himself into the first team, and even Kabak's got a job to get in the first team. He'll obviously play, but I wouldn't have thought he'll walk straight back into the side or straight into the side once he's signed the contract and he's been over for a few days. I was at the London Stadium for the West Ham game, and Nat Phillips had the game of his life. You know, he put himself up against Antonio. He fancied the fight. He fancied getting stuck in. He had a brilliant game. And Jordan Henderson at centre-half just absolutely cruised through the game. So that's not a bad partnership. You wouldn't want to rely on that. Of course, you wouldn't go into the City game and the Champions League game. So I think the signing's a good one. I've seen Kabak play quite a few times. His range of passing is excellent. He hits 40-odd balls with ease. Defending is a little bit raw, as you'd expect from a 20-year-old. But I think for the future, they're good signings.
Is that it? Stevie, anything else you'd like to say?
No, I mean, listen, as far as... I was just... When you asked Don about the title, does this change it? I don't think Liverpool can seriously think about winning the title with what they have right now on the field and signing Ben Davis and Kabak. It seems a little bit of a stretch to think they can compete for the Premier League just signing those two guys.
Well, I think it's fair to say Liverpool have a much better chance than Spurs too, of course. Title contenders just a couple of months ago. That went down the drain very, very quickly, Don. And when we asked you what you wanted to talk about today, you said you wanted to talk about Mourinho's post-match comments.
I just thought it was crazy, because I watched the game and I just didn't see the same game that Jose watched. I thought Brighton bopped them off the pitch, as they did at the Spurs Stadium a couple of months ago. They just couldn't get the win. And Tottenham never got a kick. They never got a kick in midfield. I thought Brighton's midfield outplayed them, outbossed them. At the back, they were solid. And Jose's come on national TV and said, two different halves. Spurs, not so good first half. Second half, very good. Last half an hour, he's seen his men pushing for the win and blood, sweat and tears. And I'm thinking, that ain't the game that I watched. I thought Brighton were in cruise control. So wherever he's covering up for his players, as he likes to do, but it didn't wash on me. I'm not even sure Jose believed what he was saying. He likes a little trick or two, Jose, but I tell you what, they've got some big problems when a team like Brighton can outplay you and be so comfortable.
Stevie, you did bring up the point, didn't you? When they were winning, you would say, well, what happens when they don't and they continue to play this sort of style? Players are not going to be on board for that long.
Well, no, and the guy who would keep a lot of players on board would be Harry Kane, just because of the player he is and, of course, the captain. As far as Mourinho's concerned, you know, the only thing I can come up with is that he's actually looked at the big picture. And the big picture is, whether we like it or not, or as bad as Tottenham seem to be right now, they're in the League Cup final, the Carabao Cup final, they're still in the FA Cup, and if they win the game in hand, they're only 3 points behind the top four spot. So I'm thinking he's sort of sat down and thought about this and thought, you know what, there's no point in me going out and battering these players. Number one, because we don't have our best player in Harry Kane, but is it going to do any good? So I think that's the conclusion he's come to.
Jules, where does he stand? Like regards to how hard would he have to fall, how far would he have to fall for them to take a look at his position at the club?
Well, there's obviously the winning trophy part of it. And we know that the club hasn't won anything since that League Cup under Juan de Ramos a long time ago now. So I guess if he brings the FA Cup or the League Cup or the Europa League to the club, the first trophy since 2008, then I guess this is a positive thing. But if they finish outside of the top four, this is not so positive. And I don't think that if they finish sixth or seventh, like last year, there's much improvement, even if they win a title. So I guess we would have to see the second part of the season. What I was most shocked about, I'm not too surprised by him trying to stay positive, because they need positivity right now. Harry Kane is injured. There was the clash with Aurier. We're not sure what happened with Sissoko, but it looked like once Sissoko had criticised Mourinho's tactic after the Fulham game, he disappeared completely from the team until Sunday. So there was a lot of negativity around that team, and maybe he just wanted to be for once a bit more positive. What I struggle to understand is how did he think, as he tried to explain, that Gareth Bale would be a good replacement for Harry Kane, because he would play a bit like Harry Kane, try to connect with Son. This is not the kind of player that Gareth Bale is. I mean, push and don't believe forwards and having play as a number 10, and maybe the kind of passes that Kane gives to Son and Dombele can. Gareth Bale certainly cannot do that job. So I don't know why he was trying to achieve by having Bergwijn and Bale just behind Son. But they were never going to be nowhere near the kind of players that Harry Kane is when he played in that deeper number 10 role behind Son.
We covered a lot of the Premier League this weekend. One thing which struck me was just kind of a bit weird, basically. Salah talking about VAR after Liverpool's win. VAR didn't really have too much to play in it. But he's asked about it and he said that it's killing football. He says he wants to get rid of it. What I think is interesting, Jules, and whether or not it's just because it's the Premier League and there are more eyes on it, you just feel that England have embraced VAR less than any other country.
Yes, and maybe you can understand it in the sense that he's been chaotic at times. It's been a bit of a mess because some decisions are given in one game, the same one is not given in the other game. We saw that a lot with handball, of course, last season, but also this season. And the tiniest of offside, again, all those lines coming up, the blue one, the red one, all of that. I think maybe it gets a bit on players' nerves. Certainly some players who are quite often, like Mo Salah, whether they're on the good side or the bad side of it, but quite a lot involved with it. And I think if you're Mo Salah and you're not so sure if you have to celebrate your goal or not because you're not sure if you're offside or not, maybe there's a point where you think, you know what, we were better off when there was no VAR. But you're right, the comment was a bit strange considering there was not really any VAR involvement in that game against West Ham for Mo Salah.
Why, Don? Why did... Go on, Stevie.
How about the British public and people in general love a moan-up about anything? How about that? I mean, seriously.
Craig Burley, exhibit A.
Seriously. And I can assure you, as a former player, having scored a couple of goals and had them disallowed because some idiot with a flag couldn't see past his own nose, I'm more than happy to have VAR.
Don?
Well, Mo Salah doesn't like it because he wants to score goals because he's a selfish player, and that's his opinion. But he was more or less, I think, talking about the Tottenham game when he had that goal disallowed, didn't he, for Roberto Firmino's handball. I think it's the small decisions, Dan, that I think just gets on our nerves a little bit. Have you seen the Danny Ings offside at the weekend? It was like an absolute fraction. You know, there's a Matty Cash handball that looked a stonewall penalty. And Julian's right, when you look at some of the decisions, I think as a commentator, I think it's hard for the referees and more so for the fans when you're watching on. You're looking at some incidents and you think, well, last week that would have been a penalty, or this week this would have been offside. And everything just seems a little bit inconsistent. I know they're trying hard to fix it and I know it's in its infancy, so we might have to give it a little bit of time. The one that really knocks me is, which would be my fix, and listen, I'm not the oracle, but when you see an offside decision and it's so, so close, like the Danny Ings one, in my opinion, if you got rid of the lines and you said to someone in VAR, right, what do you see with no lines on the pitch?
Is the yard offside?
If it's too tight and you literally cannot tell if someone's on or off with no lines on the pitch, let it go. Let's see more goals. That's what we want.
But the problem is with that, Don, is at least the lines give you consistency. We know that camera angles can be very deceptive. And from one camera angle, you go, he's definitely off. And another one say he's on. So why don't you use science to help you? Why would you go back a step?
Well, listen, I looked at the Sadio Mane offside. I think it was in the Everton game a few months back. And I looked at that over and over and over again. And every time I saw it, I saw Sadio Mane being onside. And the decision was offside. So I know we've got to go with it. We have to roll with it. And it's just something that I think we have to get used to. And because it is sort of brand new, it's a little bit alien to us. And it might take a little bit of time. And in 18 months' time, when a few things get tweaked, because you go back to a fair few months ago in a Man United game when Victor Lindelof got accused of handball. When a ball literally got deflected somewhere and someone headed it off his hand from 6 inches away. And as me and Stevie have played the game, I wouldn't say spirit of the game, but there's some things when you see a handball like the Lindelof one and you go, that doesn't sit right with me. That's not intentional handball. That's what VAR was not brought in to solve. Like the Danny Ings, Sadio Mane, millimetre offside. It weren't brought in for the millimetre offside. It was the gaping errors. So the fact that we're going, you know, to the nth degree to solve everything is going to take a lot of time for everyone to get used to.
Stephen?
I have absolutely no problem with it. Listen, you use what you have, you use the tools you have, and I understand that it's tough to get a goal disallowed the way Manny has and the way Danny Ings has, but I don't think you can argue that, in my opinion, I suppose it is that it's made progress. You know, we're talking about a decision that is centimetres, right? But look at all the great decisions that we've had. Look at all the stuff. And the fact is, if we didn't have VAR, we would still be having as much arguments about referees needing help, referees being inconsistent, linesmen not knowing what they're looking at. And so, overall, you've got to say it's way better having VAR than just saying, oh, that's OK, let's have human error.
It's way better, Stevie. I think it's way better in the domestic leagues. But then as soon as a couple of weeks' time comes and the Champions League's involved, there'll be a totally different ruling. So it's like the Premier League players, the Bundesliga players, Serie A and La Liga, they're getting used to the rules. But as soon as they go into Champions League and Europa League, it's like, it's a different rule.
It's no any different than playing in Europe with European referees where they give decisions against you. One referee says it's a foul, the other one says play on. It's not any different to anything else. You have to deal with it.
Yeah, but you look at the Champions League last season when Kimpembe was adjudged to have handballed a game against Man United. Never a handball in a million years.
Jules,
yet the rules seem to be different.
So the ref got a bit of decision wrong. No surprise.
Yeah, but the referee got the decision wrong and VAR got the decision wrong. So it's a double whammy.
Well, they're going to make mistakes. They're referees, they're officials, they're human. They make mistakes. Way better us being able to see something rather than sit and watch the telly and having to go with what they did without being able to see it yourself.
Jules, why the English in particular?
I think because maybe if Stevie is right, it's in the culture anyway to moan and to whinge. But more seriously, I think because VAR, because they wanted to do their thing their way, VAR, but their way, not following everybody else's rules in all the rest of Europe, in what UEFA was saying, in what FIFA was saying. They wanted their own rules for handball, their own VAR rules. Remember the first couple of seasons, the referee never used to go and check the monitor. It was there for them. Everybody else in the whole world was doing it. But they said, no, we're England. We're not going to do this. Don't go and check the monitor. And we were like, but why? Now they're doing it. It's much better. We've seen many decisions overturned because the ref finally himself went over, checked the screen, said, OK, I got it wrong or I got it right or whatever. But do you remember how stupid and silly it was when they refused at the beginning to go and check the screen? You were like, why are you doing that? So I think that didn't help at all.
Thank you very much. Go on, Stevie.
No, I think rather than just say that we like a moan up, the truth is the British are way more traditionalistic than any other country I've ever known. And that's what it is. We like tradition, and it's hard for us to change. That's the problem, as much as anything else.
We like our shepherd's pie, and we like it every night.
Correct. Yes, without corn as well. There you go.
No corn. Thank you very much. If you think Salah doesn't like VAR, wait till you hear what Don Hutchison has to say about hot cheese in Extra Time. You can check that out over on our YouTube channel.
Passion, drive and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights and more. Whether you're into speed, power or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
No doubt about it, big story in Spain this weekend. El Mundo getting a copy of Lionel Messi's contract revealed that over 4 years he was set to be paid over €500 million. Well, the front page of the Argentinian sports newspaper, Olé, responding by saying, hey, look, this is Lionel Messi. He's worth it. Let's welcome in, shall we, Sid Lowe to the show to talk about this. Sid, for me, this is weird because you look at it and it's like, well, one of the best players in the world ever gets paid a lot of money. We knew that. That's not really a surprise. So Barcelona are leaking this to try and make it look like he's the reason they've got all these financial problems?
Well, in a way, you've summed it up there really well, because on the face of it, it's not a huge big deal. Now, look, obviously, the figures are enormous. It's very unusual for a newspaper to get the actual contract itself and reveal all the clauses and reveal the exact amounts as they build up. So in that sense, it's a very big story. But you're right in terms of the basics of this, which is we all knew that he was earning in excess of €100 million a year. So that's not a huge surprise, although it's slightly higher than that. The way that it's constructed is perhaps slightly surprising, but even that's not really shocking. What makes this interesting, I think, is exactly that second part of what you've said, which is, where's this come from and why? Why has this happened? You know, in whose interest is it for this to come out? Because this isn't just a case of a newspaper doing its investigative research and somehow coming across this contract. This has been filtered out to them. This has been leaked to them in some way. And that's the question now. Where has this come from? Who benefits from what is a very clear attempt, by the way, to make Lionel Messi effectively responsible for Barcelona's current economic crisis? And that's the other part of this, of course. The context of this is that Barcelona now are in dire financial straits.
But from a fan's point of view, you think, isn't Lionel Messi's fault? You offered him the contract. You know, you've brought in a lot of other rubbish around him. You can't just suddenly point the finger at a man who, let's not forget, his contract ends in the summer. He could be out of it, and yet you're just going to put all of it at his door. How does this affect his psyche with regards to wanting to leave the club at the end of this contract?
Well, look, how it affects him, we don't really know yet, not least because I guess part of this will depend on who he believes is behind it, whether he believes this is the club as it currently is, or the club as it was before, or some other party that has led to this, whether he believes this in some meaningful way damages his relationship with Barcelona itself. The other thing is exactly as you began there. There was, a very clear attempt in this story to present Messi as the man responsible for Barcelona's financial crisis for a number of reasons. Look, one of them, in terms of you look at how the report was put together. Now, the fact of having the contract is in itself a big piece of news, but it was presented in a very specific way. You look at the front page headline. The front page headline was the gigantic contract that Lionel Messi has that's driving Barcelona to ruin. So this wasn't just saying, as you rightly put it, you know, best player in the world has best contract in the world. This was saying this guy is ruining Barcelona. And actually, I think the way that a huge number of fans have responded, and a lot of people in the media too, exactly the way that you have, which is to say, well, he's the best player in the world. It's not his fault. He didn't force anyone to give him this contract. He's not at the heart of the financial mismanagement. And a lot of people have said, and by the way, he probably generates more money than anyone else. In fact, we've seen studies over the course of today suggesting that he generates around about a third of Barcelona's income himself. We've seen all sorts of studies about his financial, but also his footballing importance at the club. You know, the fact that he's been there for almost 40% of all the league titles that Barcelona have won in their entire history, for 80% of the Champions League titles they've won in their entire history. So a lot of people have looked at that and said, well, the problem isn't Lionel Messi earning this much money. The problem is all these mediocre players who weren't very good earning a lot of money and the money that we wasted on them. So in terms of a storyline that was designed to put the blame very definitely at Messi's door, or that it's entirely succeeded if indeed that was the aim.
Well, he won't be getting any bonuses for winning La Liga this year. That, of course, will go to Atletico Madrid. And it's Luis Suarez, who is the top goal scorer in Spain. Sid, how's this been received in Catalonia?
quite badly. I think there are two different things here. One is whether or not it was the right decision to move Luis Suarez on for him to no longer be at Barcelona. The other, of course, is whether, in moving Luis Suarez on, what you should really do is send him to a direct competitor and send him there for free. And not only there, send him there for free, but send him there for free and with a reason to want revenge. And so I think that's been the focal point of the response to Luis Suarez over the last 3 or 4 weeks. It hasn't really been, oh my God, we should have kept him. It's more being, oh my God, how on earth did we think it was a good idea to help Atletico Madrid out? And Barcelona have done this before, by the way. With David Villa, Atletico Madrid won the league in 2014, having just left Barcelona. And that's not quite the same case, but there are certain parallels. And so, yeah, I think the focus has been more on the way that Barcelona handled the exit plan rather than on the specific case of whether or not Luis Suarez should still be at the Camp Nou.
The one silver lining for Barcelona at the moment is that Real Madrid are in just a bigger mess. We talked a lot, haven't we, Sid, about the transfers that Barcelona brought in and how they haven't worked out. Yet it seems time and time again you take a look at this Real Madrid team and it's the same team as it has been for the last 5 years, because everyone they bring in isn't good enough, and that's shown again this weekend. And it's just a tiresome kind of vicious circle for Madrid.
Yeah, I mean, look, when people look at the Real Madrid team as it currently stands, I think that there are two ways of analysing it. And one is, as you've just said, to look at the people they've bought in, the players they've bought in, by the way, and a lot of them really quite expensive, albeit Hazard is the only kind of, you know, super Galactico among them. He's the only sort of 80, 90, 100 million euro plus player. And you can look at those players and say, well, look, they're simply not good enough. But I think from Real Madrid's institutional point of view, from a club point of view, they look at them and say, well, they could be good enough if they were given opportunities, if they were given continuity, if they were given the chance to play. And that's one of the reasons, I think, why we're seeing a slight fracturing in the relationship between Zidane and the club. Now, there's always the potential for that at Real Madrid. We know this. It's always been the case. But I think Real Madrid believe that Zidane has been too much of a defender of the old guard. And therefore, the young guard have if you like, not being allowed to show whether or not they're good enough. Because, of course, if you take for example, someone like Odre Othola, who played this weekend. Now, personally, I'm not convinced that Odre Othola is quite good enough for Real Madrid. That's not to say he's not a good footballer, but not quite good enough for Real Madrid. But, of course, even if he was, this is a guy who comes into the team having not played for, what, 3 months, having been out on loan last season. And so you look at it and think, well, even if he was good, would he perform in these kind of circumstances?
The issue is, if you take Jovic, for example, of course, has now gone back to Germany and scoring goals for fun. He did have his chances under Zidane, but I suppose there's only so much time you can give him before you go, look, this is Real Madrid. You either sink and swim, and you're going to be judged very quickly. That's just the life of at a big club.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And you know, you use Jovic there as an example. And Martin Ødegaard, of course, is a very clear example of this as well. A player who last year was arguably, at least until lockdown, the best, or certainly the best 3 or 4 players in the whole of La Liga, playing for Real Sociedad on loan. He went back to Real Madrid, who recalled him from loan a year early. I think we all knew that there was a chance this wouldn't work. And why is there a chance this wouldn't work? Well, because he's young, because the demands at Real Madrid are far greater, and of course, because the players ahead of him are that little bit better. We're not saying Martin Ødegaard is no good, but you are looking at it and thinking, but the two players in front of him are Toni Kroos and Luka Modric. I mean, that's a pretty big deal. And then if he doesn't get continuity, if he doesn't get confidence, then of course the performances drop. And it's very difficult. And you're quite right. That's the thing. There isn't time for this. Now, in theory, at least, to bring young players through, you need patience. They need continuity. They need confidence. But this is Real Madrid. You lose one game and it's a crisis. The same as happens at Barcelona. The managers are under pressure. And so you can talk about patience being a virtue, but no one's given the time to be allowed to be patient.
Sid, they're not going to win anything this season. Where will that leave Zidane?
Well, you know, in the last, 10, 14 days, they've lost the Spanish Super Cup, knocked out the Copa del Rey. They're now 10 points behind, plus a game in hand in La Liga, so they're probably not going to win that. That's true, although, you know, football's a strange game. I guess the hope now is all pinned on the Champions League. Their performances in big games suggest that they can at least believe that they've got a chance to go some way. They will believe that they're favourites against Atalanta. What happens to Zidane if they win nothing is, I think, that he doesn't continue, but I think they do stay with him till the end of the season. To be honest with you, though, I think even if they were to win something, there's a very strong chance that he's not there next year. Whether that's by mutual consent, whether that's by him walking away, whether it's by them pushing him. I don't think that Zidane is the Real Madrid manager next season, no matter what happens this season.
Sid Lowe, thank you very much. A lot more from Sid, by the way, on the latest edition of the Gab and Jules podcast, where he's their special guest. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't a search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/FC. Just go to Indeed.com/FC right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the podcast. Indeed.com/FC, terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. The US men kicked off 2021 in some style, beating Trinidad and Tobago by 7-0. Casey Keller and Steve Cherundolo with me. Twitter would have me believe you're going to win the World Cup now in 2026, Casey.
If we could play Trinidad, sure. and this Trinidad side, which... Well, look, it's a difficult situation in Trinidad. You know, they had the Federation was suspended by FIFA. You had the domestic league shut down all of last year. It was tough. And, you know, they tried to put a team together last minute because the U.S. was trying to play Serbia, and because of different COVID lockdowns and visa issues, Trinidad stepped up and came and played when they knew darn well that they weren't ready to play this match. But, you know, don't take it away from the U.S. that you can only play the team that's in front of you. And, you know, some players got some opportunities and came out. I thought Jonathan Lewis, you know, looked like an option maybe going forward with his pace out wide, creating some great situations. Matt Turner got his debut in goal, had really nothing to do but a silly penalty late, and he was able to come up with the big save. So, you know, maybe Greg learned a couple things in this match, but for the most part, he probably learned 10 guys that he'll never call back again.
And that's the issue, isn't it, Steve? Because we've talked so much about the abundance of talent that are now plying their trade in Europe, and that's who these guys are competing with.
Yes, and it's great to see that, you know, all these new players getting caps, gathering this valuable experience as an international friendly. And it's great to see that they're scoring goals. I mean, you still have to go out and create chances, cause mistakes for the defenders, and put those chances away. So these are all good signs, but there's always that question mark. There's always an asterisk that right next to the scoreline. Can they do this against top quality opponents? Can they do this in World Cup qualifiers away and at home? And but I do think, you know, as Casey said correctly, I think Greg will take away what he thought he probably was able to take away from this game, and they'll grow on that and move forward. And I think really the players are the big winners here. They're going to have some experiences to remember, and they can take this confidence into their MLS season.
Danry Camp worth it, Casey?
I think it kind of depends on how you look at it. If you look at it as almost an under 23 camp with getting some of your veterans back touching the ball as opposed to having a 3-4 month break because maybe they got knocked out early in MLS and with not knowing when exactly the MLS is going to start. Yes, they've set a date, but there's still some question mark on that. So, I mean, there are, I think, some benefits, but if you're truly preparing, let's say Greg had a World Cup qualifier in March. No, this didn't help at all because this isn't going to look anything like the side that's going to play in March. So yes, there's some benefit, but pretty minimal.
Let's talk about some of the players who, of course, didn't feature in January camp. One is Chris Richards. It's confirmed that he's made that loan move, Steve, from Bayern Munich to Hoffenheim. Looks like a great move for him.
It's an excellent move, especially moving forward, thinking forward to next season where Bayern is going to have some trouble in their back line. They will most likely lose two of their starters, Alaba and Boateng. And, you know, there have been players before him who have made this move. You know, thinking back of Serge Gnabry, who made the move to Hoffenheim, where he flourished into a German national team player and is now a starter at Bayern. A defender in Philipp Lahm, we all remember that name. Wasn't able to break through early on in his career at Bayern. Went to VfB Stuttgart for 2 years. The rest is history, world champion, Champions League winner, and all of that. So he's in good company, and I think this is a very smart move for him. Now, it's imperative now that he gets some time on the field and he learns, and he gets to knows the ins and outs of the Bundesliga, his new club, and just grows as a player.
Steve, you mentioned there, obviously, that they could be missing two centre-backs next season. Alaba going to move on. And what's interesting is Karl-Heinz Rummenigge saying, yeah, Upamecano would come in as the perfect replacement. This is very un-Bayern-like, not taking the best players. They do that all the time. We know that, but making it so public.
Yes, it is. I think it's maybe a new approach. I think they realize they have some competition trying to sign Upamecano. He's a very fantastic center back already, has an enormous amount of experience for only being 22 years old. And there's a huge upside to him. So I think maybe Bayern is just kind of staking their claim and maybe trying to scare any other clubs off. That may be the tactic that Karl-Heinz Rummenigge and his colleagues are taking.
No-brainer for Bayern. We know the talent that he has. For him, Casey, it seems like a sensible move as well, despite being linked to a number of Premier League clubs.
Well, obviously, there's a level of comfort staying in the Bundesliga, going to a giant the size of Bayern Munich and keep going as opposed to, you know, going to England or Spain, let's say, and then having to kind of relearn the league and go from there. But Upamecano has done a fantastic job at Leipzig. And as we've seen so often, Bayern is able to then not only strengthen their side, but weaken some of their competition for the years in the future years. So it's a big move, I think, for Bayern, because no question they need to strengthen at the center back position. I thought it was a good point that Steve made with Chris Richards being able to get some experience, because it's so difficult for a club like Bayern to be able to just throw somebody in that spine of the team, right in that center back, 20-year-old kid being able to go in there. So they strengthen in one position. Maybe Boateng stays. There was some talk as well that maybe Boateng could be able to stay and then have some experience with someone else. And let's say a Chris Richards who goes and plays at Hoffenheim for the second half of this season with his old coach, that must be said, with Sebastian Hoeneß, who was the Bayern 2 coach last season and the U19 coach before that, who obviously had worked with Chris Richards and had that confidence to bring him in. So then you have a young, experienced center back, an older, experienced center back, and then a kid who had gained some experience on loan coming back to your side and working in at times as the season progresses.
Meanwhile, Borussia Dortmund back to winning ways. And it's interesting, Steve, that Jadon Sancho, 2021 version, is like the old version that we all knew and fell in love with. That touch for the goal is just fantastic. It's like he's not thinking about it anymore.
And that's the key. It's not to think about it. Jadon Sancho is an instinct player. He doesn't really think he's at his best when he does the first thing that pops in his head, and he's also at his best when he has that ever so important confidence to really pull off what he's just pops in his head for the first idea. And we're seeing that come back. There's no hesitation anymore in his decision making. There's no hesitation anymore in his dribble. He's using his pace. He's using his technical ability. And he has that hunger again to score goals, to set up goals. This is a great sign for Borussia Dortmund, and an even better sign for this young man who's looking for a big move this summer. I think that's got definitely on the back of his head. I think he's over the non-transfer this past summer. And so I think he seems to be clear in his head, his way of thinking. And that's the Jadon Sancho we fell in love with.
Dortmund, of course, battling for a place in the top four. Occupying third at the moment is Wolfsburg, Casey, on a great run at the moment. We saw John Brookson scoring again at the weekend. Can they make a Champions League place?
I think they can. I think you're now looking at about five or six teams really competing for the Champions League spots. We saw Gladbach go on a good run to pop up there. We've seen Leverkusen, in those spots. And then falter. We've seen Union Berlin as well, kind of floating up around those areas. And Wolfsburg, I think, have won three in a row, which has then popped them in there. Yeah, John Brooks, you would have expected, this towering header, but instead it kind of bounces around in the box, ricochets off somebody, and it was a real, real cool left-footed strike to get that opening goal. But they've got Weghorst, who just continues to score goals. When you can really count on one guy to get you a bunch of goals, that's what Wolfsburg has really relied on. And then you get, a group of other players popping up to help out. They've been solid defensively. They've been tough to beat. I think they were the last team this season to lose. So, yeah, I don't see any reason why Wolfsburg can't finish up in a Champions League spot. But it really looks like Bayern's going to win again, and then it's going to be a fun battle for those remaining three spots.
Steve, with a U.S. perspective on this, John Brooks should be the first choice center back, and it shouldn't even be a discussion, should it?
In this form that John Brooks is playing in right now, I agree with you 100%. He's a threat on the offensive end, on set pieces. His build-up play out of the back is very good. He's a strong left foot, very accurate passing, whether it's on the floor or up in the air. His defensive heading is also excellent. He's moving well. His tactical awareness is on point as well. He's flourished into a veteran in this league and now playing a team who will qualify, as it looks right now, for an international spot. So he ticks all the boxes to be your number one defender on that back line of the U.S. national team.
One last word from you, Stevie. Ozan Kabak looks like he's making that move from Schalke to Liverpool on loan. What can you tell us about him?
Well, Kabak is a player who fits the role of an FC Liverpool or a Jurgen Klopp coach team very well. He's an aggressive defender, loves to leave the back line and dart forward into the midfield to make tackles. Covers ground well, has good speed, it's good in the air, 1v1. You know, an area where he could build upon is his in-box defending and his positioning. He's still a little raw and young in that area, but the move to Liverpool would be fantastic for him and his career, and playing in the EPL would certainly just push him up to that next level. So this is a good move for everybody, in my opinion.
Liverpool fans will go, wait, Schalke, aren't they that team that went 31 games without winning? Why should we be excited about getting one of their centre-backs, Steve?
Well, I think once I see him play, he has an aggressive style. He's very emotional on the pitch. You know, he played at Galatasaray in the Champions League. He's done very well at Schalke. He was good at Stuttgart. So he's definitely proven himself that he can play at a very high level. Now it's just up to him to play that level consistently. And I do think the English fans will certainly appreciate his effort and his mentality out on the pitch.
Gentlemen, as always, thank you very much. The German Cup is our priority this week. You can watch all of these matches on ESPN3 by Leverkusen in action on Tuesday as our Borussia Dortmund. And then on Wednesday, it's Wolfsburg against Schalke, and Stuttgart play host to Borussia Mönchengladbach.
Did you know less than 10% of Americans own an e-bike? Here's why that should change. Studies show e-bike owners actually end up exercising more, plus getting outside more. If you're looking for a balanced lifestyle and everyday adventures, you need to check out Lectric e-bikes. They are the number one selling e-bike brand in America. Their bikes are typically foldable, pre-assembled, and have serious range up to 150 miles on some models. Check them out today at lectricebikes.com and add some more adventure to your week. That's lectricebikes.com.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the playoff intensity to finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sportsbook bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
Meanwhile, Coppa Italia action as well at the semi-final stages. These matches available on Plus. Tomorrow, Inter taking on Juve. And then on Wednesday, Napoli against Atalanta. Just a reminder, those games played over two legs. Well, that's it. That brings us to the end of today's show. Thank you very much, as always, for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow for more. But be sure to stay tuned. Extra Time is next with Don and Sid. Welcome into the latest edition of Extra Time. Sid Lowe and Don Hutchinson with us to answer your tweets. Don, what was transfer deadline day like for the squad? Not knowing if someone was coming or going? Or did you have a pretty good idea of who would be bought or sold?
Oh, it was classic. It was classic inside the dressing rooms. Everyone's sitting there with a bag semi-packed. Are you going? Are you not going? Carnage, really, because you're literally sitting by your phone and you're thinking, am I going? As a player, if you are on the move, you've always, you know, your agents already tipped you off that you could be on the move, so prepare. But looking around the squad, it was interesting when you're seeing people laughing and joking and people not happy, trying to figure out which one's staying and which one's moving.
Don, did you move on deadline day ever?
I don't think I moved on deadline day. I think my moves were before there was even a deadline day sort of built into the schedule. I think I moved quite a few times, but not on a deadline day.
Sid, it doesn't seem to be as big in Spain as it is in the UK.
No, although they're trying to, this is one of the things that makes me laugh about it watching in Spain. They're trying to make it big.
Right.
So they've watched the way that it's kind of been built up in England. They've watched the way that it's become kind of an event. And they thought, well, let's try and do this. Now, of course, the one big flaw of this, as indeed has been noticed in England over the last 3 or 4 years, is that quite often nothing happens. So you have this thing where, let's turn this into something. Right, okay. So, anyone want a drink? because just, you know, so little happens. And so you get a few kind of like minor little loan deals, but they haven't really found a way of building the drama to quite the same extent. But you know, they'll keep trying. The thing is, obviously, look, we're talking about a league that doesn't have the, you know, isn't flush for cash in quite the same way as the Premier League. And so you're not going to get that same volume. And certainly not the same level of deadline day moves.
Sid, are PSG still the favourites for their clash against Barcelona, or are they now even given Barca's recent form? And indeed, PSG's recent form.
Funny you should say that. I was driving back from a game last night, listening to the radio here in Spain, and they were having this exact debate. One of them piped up, there were sort of five or six of them in the studio talking about this. It was immediately after the Barcelona Athletic Club game. And someone said, look, I tell you what, you're all going to laugh, but I think Barcelona go through against PSG. And he was right. Most of them did laugh.
Right.
But I think there is a feeling that Barcelona are starting to find their feet, that maybe in, what are we, 3 weeks away, is it, or 2 weeks away now? That maybe in a couple of weeks' time, if this continues, that it's not impossible. Also, as you say, because they're watching Paris Saint-Germain and thinking that maybe they're not quite as good as we thought they were a month or so ago.
Sid, how did Barcelona get in such a financial mess and not once get flagged by financial fair play like City or Chelsea?
Because in a way, one fundamental reason, because they weren't breaking financial fair play rules. What they were doing was borrowing money that they were putting off. The income was still very, very high. But of course, the nature of this is that income needs to continue being high. It needs to keep on coming in. And of course, they got into a position where it stopped. And it stopped because of the pandemic, but that's not to say that it's purely the pandemic's fault. This is to do with the fact that Barcelona mismanaged. It's to do with the fact that they put themselves in difficulties in terms of liquidity, in terms of the cash flow and so on. And to give you a couple of examples of how they avoided financial fair play, look at the deal that brought Neto to Barcelona. And in particular, look at the supposed swap deal between Pjanic and Artur Melo. Now, these were two players, one who left Juventus to go to Barcelona and one who left Barcelona to go to Juventus, who were more or less valued at the same amount. But what happened, of course, was that in terms of the accounting, not the actual money, and this is a really important point, the way that you account for your money is not necessarily the same way as you actually are able to count your money. In terms of the accounting, the money from the outgoing player, that turns up right now. The money that you're paying for the incoming player, well, that will be spread over the next 4 or 5 years. And so those kind of, if you like, I wouldn't quite call them financial engineering, although that's the phrase that gets used here a lot, but those kind of ways of manipulating the figures enable you to continue to fulfill the criteria of financial fair play.
Don, as we heard in your commentary last night in the Liverpool game, you were praising Thiago a lot. How good was he?
Oh, he was amazing, Dan. I just think he's so cultured on the ball. He finds time, he finds space. I was trying to put myself in the shoes of Declan Rice and Thomas Soucek, trying to play against him with Liverpool's three. And he doesn't play like a conventional midfield player. He doesn't really play like a six or an eight. You know, he's got the freedom to sort of wander. And then when he's intelligent enough to find space, it's the way he manipulates the ball, his technique. He's always scanning for passes forward. He's looking for the difficult passes, the amount of times he, you know, plays them balls where he's looking to Trent at the right-hand side and he whips the ball through into Mo Salah's feet. So centre-forwards are going to love playing him because he's different class. He's just so good.
What's in that jar, Don?
What jar?
That jar? Yeah, what's in it?
That might be a little bit of cream. Not my cream. almond coconut cream. Nothing to do with me.
Ah, dear.
God, are you joining us from the bathroom?
What's going on? No, I mean, I can bring a little bit of perfume in if you like.
I've just got this image of this almond coconut.
It's a coconut, it's a cream for that rash. Oh, dear. Sid, are Sevilla underrated? They play good football and they're more consistent compared to Barcelona and Madrid and arguably have a better manager than both of them.
But they are below both of them in the league.
Yeah.
So I suppose the question is, are they underrated by who? Whose rating
even
are we talking
Lampard
about?
Could
I think
be
most him. People in Spain. Yes. Although that was a very strange game where both teams played pretty much reserve sides, which was quite surprising in a way because actually first place in the group was up for grabs.
Sid, that was I Frank Lampard's Sevilla greatest ever achievement.
Spain,
don't slag him off in front of Don; he'll get angry.
Why the hate, Dan, from Frank Lampard?
I'm just saying it was a strange game. I'm not slagging anyone off. I'm just saying it was a strange game. In which, by the way, I was there. In which Giroud was absolutely outrageously good. But that's kind of by the by. I think within Spain, I think Sevilla are a team that everybody really quite admires. I think they're seen as a team that have really significant variety in the way that they play, that have an assurance about them right now. And of course, they've just signed Papu Gomez. Now, I don't watch enough Italian football to be able to judge exactly what kind of role he's going to play. But I'm excited about him because everybody who's watched him says he's really quite special.
What a player, Sid.
Hey, see, I'm excited now. Don, that's it. I'm looking forward to this.
There you go. What a game that should be. Who's it playing? Sevilla, Borussia Dortmund in the Champions League. Whoa. Sid, let's talk food. Yeah. What's your favourite tapa? The one you're always happily surprised with when it's brought to your table?
Well, if it's your favourite, you're not really surprised by it, are you?
That's a nice question. Why are you having a go at Super Frank's Bouncy IQ?
Sorry, I'm not having a go. No, but and genuinely, it does depend if it's good or not. A good tortilla is brilliant. A bad tortilla is a complete waste of time. The same goes for ham. If you get bad ham, it's not great. Good ham is brilliant. I'm quite a big fan of chickpeas and chorizo. Is nice.
Right. See, I would go pimientos de padrón.
Yes, the Russian roulette.
Yeah, that's always good. That's always good. Look at Don. Don nodded.
You got me. I'm thinking, where do I come into this conversation? chilies. Yeah, that's a bit of me.
And a bit of pulpo. If you get a good bit of pulpo, obviously, as well.
Yeah, pulpo's good. Lots of paprika. Good olive oil. Pulpo's good.
There you go. Don's palate is about sophisticated as Steve Nichol.
Culture on this show tonight. I mean, what happened to a good, well-done steak?
Oh, why do you have to bring it up again, Don?
Listen, we're quite basic like from the Northeast.
I mean, I've got no problems with this.
Well-done steak, Sid.
Do you like a parmo?
No,
I wouldn't have it well done.
Sid and Dan, I've got a thing indoors about hot cheese.
Right, I was going to say, make a reference to the cream, but I won't, right?
No, my girlfriend and my eldest, Max, who's 20, they absolutely rip me all the time about cheese. I love cold cheese, so I love a bit of cheese, a bit of cheddar, a bit of cheese. The minute you warm cheese up and put it on a burger or make hot cheese, it's terrible.
Wow.
Yeah, disgusting.
Yeah, I can see that. There's a certain logic to that.
Sid, what's the Argentinian cheese?
Does this mean you don't like pizza?
What's the Argentinian cheese that they grill, Sid? That is delicious.
Ah, provoleta.
Oh, my God. That's fantastic. Shove that in Don's face. He'd hate it.
That's going to ruin my steak, that is. Well done, steak with hot cheese on.
So when you have like a spag bowl, no.
I'll tell you what, the well done thing.
God. Oh no, love a bit of Parmesan, but it's cold.
But then that warms it up, doesn't it? It melts it.
Yeah, but you're putting cold cheese on things. Cold cheese is fine. It's melting the cheese, like on a burger or a steak or something.
But
it's
the
like,
cheese melts what? On the cheese melts on the bolognese.
Wait. Don. Just one thing, right?
Yeah.
If you don't like warm cheese and melted cheese in any way, does this mean you hate pizza?
No, that's the thing, Sid. I love pizza.
This is the most. Why would you bring up such a ridiculous point, Don, that makes you look so foolish?
Well, no, it's just it's a fact. If someone serves me a burger with cheese on, I'm like, no, that's not for me.
That seems to be the one example. That's it. You don't like cheeseburgers.
Hot cheese. I don't like hot cheese.
Where else? Where else in your life has someone given you hot cheese that's made you
cheese
this angry?
Fondue. Do you like a cheese fondue?
No.
What about lasagna?
Yeah, I do like a little bit of lasagna. Listen, it's meat. I don't want cheese on my meat.
What about Stevie's?
Well, what's on a lasagna for crying out loud?
Yeah, but there's layers there, man.
Do you want
six layers?
Cheese on the top of your shepherd's pie?
No. Keep it basic. Shepherd's pie, bit of mash, bit of meat underneath. No, I think it's a burger thing.
Okay.
I think it's a burger thing.
Yeah, that seems to be the thing. You don't like cheeseburgers, and then you just went a little bit too far. Speaking of horrible taste...
Is this just a Patrick Burger thing?
Was it
some issue with Patrick Burger? Is this...
He's younger than you, John, isn't he?
Yeah, good looking as well.
Younger, good looking, better.
All right. I mean... You know, I could say Sebastian's a lot better, good looking than you, Dan, a bit younger. But I wouldn't go there. I wouldn't say it. I wouldn't say Sebby's good looking or younger. I wouldn't go there.
Well, that's because you'd be wrong. Okay, final thing. Does Don plan on bringing back his awful mustache?
No, that was just a lockdown thing. That was a lockdown one in the summer. Yeah. Hopefully, lockdowns are over. No more tash.
No more mustache. Perfect. No. Well, there we are. Good. That's quite eclectic. Thank you very much. That brings us to the end of Extra Time. We'll be back tomorrow for more. Don's off to scrape the cheese off his burger.
Did you know less than 10% of Americans own an e-bike? Here's why that should change. Studies show e-bike owners actually end up exercising more, plus getting outside more. If you're looking for a balanced lifestyle and everyday adventures, you need to check out Lectric e-bikes. They're the number one selling e-bike brand in America. Their bikes are typically foldable, pre-assembled, and have serious range up to 150 miles on some models. Check them out today at LectricEbikes.com and add some more adventure to your week. That's LectricEbikes.com.